Well, good day, and welcome to another edition of the National Conservative Institute of Australia podcast. My guest today is Dr. Philip Amata, who is an academic at the University of Western Australia, an author, a regular columnist at the Catholic Weekly, and one of the more knowledgeable people about the state of the Catholic Church in Australia today. She's just released a new book, Witness, the Future Catholic Church in Australia, which, amongst other things, contains probably the most comprehensive and up-to-date data about the true state of the Church and Catholic-branded organisations in Australia today. It does not paint a pretty picture. However, she is a friend of the Church, and the book also contains some thoughtful analysis about what she thinks its future should look like. In our chat, we discuss why non-Catholics and others should care about the state of the Catholic Church in Australia, how dire things really are, what the cause is of this situation, and whether we need a Catholic doge to get the organisation as a whole focused on its true mission, and much more. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Well, welcome Philip Amata to the NACCON Australia podcast, and congrats on your new book, Witness, the Future Catholic Church in Australia.
Thank you very much, Dan. Available at all good bookstores. And actually, as of last night, it's available on Amazon. So I was really thrilled to see that. That jolly things along a bit.
Fantastic. I'll be sure to pop it in the show notes so people watching this can click through and purchase it straight away. Philippa, why should non-Catholics care about the state of the Catholic Church in Australia today?
Oh, bunch of reasons. If you're a non-Catholic, but you're interested in kind of the taxpayer angle, the economic angle in particular, because you know at the moment people are going absolutely spare in the US about taxpayers' money going, you know, into black holes and, you know, not knowing where that's going. We do have a bit of a similar situation with the Catholic Church in Australia. So if you're a secular person and you're interested in where taxpayers' money goes, you could ask some questions. I think we've got to the point where serious questions could be asked about the amount of taxpayers' money that's kind of being, I don't like to use the word laundered, but I'm probably going to use it. There you go. A kind of rinsed, shall we say, through a lot of Catholic origin agencies with the name Catholic on them, Catholic branding. There's a whole issue there, and I did a whole chapter in the book on it because I was appalled when I found out the amounts that were being involved and being channeled direction. Yeah.
You use the analogy in the book of describing the Catholic Church in Australia today as like a football club. Can you expand a bit on that? Because I thought it was a good one to get people to understand the true state of things.
Yes. Clarifying, of course, Dan, that there is only one form of football in Australia, as far as I'm concerned, which is Australian rules. So that was very much what I had in my mind. Yeah, let's just go straight for it. Yeah. Trouble. That was very much what I had in my mind. It's like there's the Catholic Football Club, and back in the day, there were hundreds of thousands of supporters, and they all used to go to the fixtures, and there were lots of, you know, good players in the teams, and everybody was very involved and excited. But that's actually just completely dwindled now. So we have this very elderly remaining team, and they're playing in these fixtures, and they're really not playing very hard because they're all old and they don't want to hurt each other. And there's very few people in the grandstands now watching. But down the road, as I say, there's a gigantic Catholic football club, hotel, casino and spa complex. And that's heavily subsidised by the federal and state governments. And that is enormously popular. And there's hundreds of thousands of people using the casino and staying in the hotel and going to the spa. But they're not watching football on the big screens. You know, they're not interested in the Catholic football club. They just like the facility. And then every now and then somebody says, you know, should we really be subsidising this enormous, you know, entertainment complex down the road? Because, you know, not everyone is a Catholic and not everyone is a football fan. But then everybody protests and says, oh, but it's employing all these people. It's providing services that people want. It's a tradition, you know. And so we have this discussion every now and then. Usually when a state or federal government suggests cutting any kind of funding or reducing any kind of funding to the Catholic education system in particular, we always hear these arguments. It's like, oh, but it's doing such good, you know. And so there's that. That's the analogy I used, because I do think we might have reached that point. There's a whole lot of Catholic origin stuff existing next door to the Catholic Church, and it's got the Catholic name on it and the Catholic branding. but it is being very heavily subsidised, and it's not being subsidised by the Catholic Church. It's being subsidised by ordinary Australian taxpayers. And it's true, they're getting a lot of benefit from the healthcare system. They like sending their kids to Catholic schools because it is affordable private education. I get all of that. I'm just questioning now, what does the actual Catholic Church have to do with this any longer? If this stuff is all running itself, where does what I call in the book the parochial diocesan church, the bit, you know, where people go to church on Sundays and there's bishops and all of that kind of stuff, how does that work now with this enormous carapace on the other side of Catholics Inc.? Tracy Rowland calls it Catholics Inc., and I think that's a really good name for it.
Yeah. The guts of your book is a lot of data and data crunching and your investigations to try to work out, amongst other things, how many Catholics are actually going to Mass each Sunday, which is a good metric for working out, you know, what the actual state of the Catholic Church is, because that is an obligation on Catholics to attend Mass each Sunday. And like you said, there's this other church which is taxpayer subsidized and has Catholic branding. On the actual weeklies, as you call them, how dire are things in Australia today for the Mass going Catholics?
I'd say pretty bloody dire, actually, Dan, to be absolutely honest. The people who, dialing back a bit, every 5 years, the Australian Catholic Bishops Conference, or ACBC, runs a national count of attendance through something that they call the Pastoral Research Centre. So they actually do like a headcount. Now, I can't remember ever being involved in this headcount, so I don't know actually how it works on the ground and how accurate this is, but it's the best we've got. And part of the book also is looking at data in the Catholic Church in Australia, because a lot of it is like this kind of, this is kind of the best we've got kind of number. The Mass attenders, I split them into three groups. We did a survey of Catholics in Australia, myself and Professor Stephen Bullivant, who's done a lot of work in this area with Catholics in the UK and in the United States. We surveyed a group of Australian Catholics. We got about 2,300 of them, and we split them up into the people we called the weeklies, who go to Mass every Sunday and maybe more often, the irregulars, who go kind of less than that, but they do go from time to time, and then a group, the nevers, who just never go to Mass, even though they call themselves Catholic. And we found enormous differences in levels of belief and behaviour and practice as Catholics between those three groups, actually between two groups, between the weeklies and everybody else. So the weeklies are kind of your core Catholic people. They go to church on Sundays. They are involved in their parishes. They're doing the heavy lifting for the parochial diocesan church. They're really, and the younger ones, the ones under 40, are kind of the future. And so looking at those people under 40 who are going to Mass every Sunday tells us a lot about the likely shape of the future church in Australia. What do they believe? What do they think? Do they want women priests? Do they want, you know, a whole bunch of other stuff? And the answer is no, they don't. They really don't. They're actually remarkably conservative and remarkably committed to the point where Stephen Bullivant describes it as almost like a doubling down. They're almost ultra Catholic, ultra conservative, very orthodox, because they're trying to make a difference. They're trying to be different from the world around them. So things are pretty dire, because that group is actually not very big. And currently the Mass goers are mostly aged over 70, like two-thirds of them, according to the estimates we've got. They're aged over 70, and it's like a mushroom. There's this big canopy of these old people, and then there's this very narrow stem of the under 70s. And the narrow stem, it's quite a small number of people.
So, and what are we talking? I think the numbers in your book is, if I got them right, is about, did you say 400,000 or thereabouts?
Yeah, 417,335 or something like that, which is a surprisingly accurate number for something that's a count like this, you know, which again makes me ask questions. But that was the final count that we got in the last national count of attendance, which was 2021. Now, that was March and September 2021. They did the count over a period of time because of COVID and because of the church lockdowns, trying to capture as many open churches. But I think it's probably a robust count. And that was a drop of about 200,000 people from the previous count. Because the previous count in 2016 was actually over 600,000. So suddenly there's been this enormous drop. Yeah.
Yeah, right. And you did projections as well, right? And again, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you said by 2050 in Australia, there would likely be only about 200,000 or thereabout Catholic with attending mass. And that would be of a population of in Australia, well, 35, potentially closer to 40 million people. So it'd be an absolute minority of people.
Yeah. In fact, I was talking about this with a friend of mine the other night, and he said, I think you've been generous. And I agree with him. I think I have been generous. I think we might hit the 200,000 mark a lot sooner. I will be watching the 2026 count of attendance with great interest because we might even hit it round about then, for all we know. You know, there's a lot of things that we can't control with this number. But, yeah, I just did really simple projections. So what percentage of people have you lost in the last 10 years? Let's take that forward and assume you're going to keep losing people at that rate going forward to 2050. And that's how I came up with that number.
But, I mean, it's true, isn't it, that the Catholic, people who describe themselves as nominally Catholic is still the largest denomination in Australia, right?
Yeah, I do believe so, but that may not be the case for much longer with the rise of the nuns, you know, the people who have no religion, that's really rising. And I think willingness to identify as Catholic is going to drop as well. I mean, it's already dropped. It dropped a lot between the last two censuses.
Right.
I think it's down to about 20% of the population now is willing to identify as Catholic. I think going forward, that's going to drop 15%, you know, 10% of the population might be willing. But as that number drops, I think it's like the tide going out. We'll be starting to get more and more people in that number who actually are affiliated Catholics rather than nominal ones. So, yes, it might drop down to, 3 million willing to identify as Catholics, but perhaps a slightly bigger percentage of them will be affiliated.
So you've got all these, you've got this nominal number of Catholics, which is still quite high, although it's dropping. You've got all these organizations, Catholic schools, Catholic churches, real estate, social enterprises, health institutes, but none of those people, the vast majority of people, professional Catholics that work for all the, you know, the diocesan organizations, but only very, 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 very small proportion of those actually go practice Catholic in the way that, I don't know, G.K. Chesterton would recognise, right?
Go to Mass on Sundays, Dan. That's the bar. Go to Mass and I set the bar very low.
Because I think you also said that even the guys that are attending at the moment, there's a bit of a mixture of what those people attend. And some would be attending more for sort of social reasons rather than any matter of any, I don't know, because of Orthodox Catholic kind of reasons, right?
Yeah, paradoxically, a lot of the boomers, actually, there's the boomers. When we did the survey of the Catholics in Australia, the boomers were the ones who actually had the lowest measures in terms of actual belief in Catholic teaching, you know, willingness to accept it all of that kind of stuff. There was a real dip. So it's like young people are up here, and then there's this dip, and then the very, very old, the 80-plus people are up here. So very young people in the church and very old people in the church have a lot in common, but there's just this bunch in the middle, you know, where levels of belief and adherence are quite low.
So what's the cause of all this, this change? Because this would not, I assume, have been the case in Australia 50 years ago, although I think in your book you do suggest that maybe glorify the 50s of stuff as a bit of a golden age. There are some discrepancies. Maybe there wasn't as many people attending as we might have believed. But putting that to one side, there has been a precipitous decline. What's the cause of it?
Oh, so many things. So many things. The first thing most traditional-minded people say, it was all the fault of Vatican II, which actually I don't believe it was. I actually have a lot of time for Vatican II, mainly because I've read the documents rather than listening to the piffle that's talked about it. A lot of things changed. And I think the changes to the liturgy are a factor, the fact that the Mass was turned into English. Not that it was turned into English. That wasn't the problem. But that it was fiddled with such a lot. And a lot of priests in the church particularly got the bit between their teeth and decided that because the Mass had been turned into English, they could experiment with it in all sorts of different formats. And that just, it puts people off. People left in droves, I think, because of that. people say Humanae Vitae was probably a big turning point for a lot of people, which is when the Pope said that artificial contraception couldn't be used in good conscience by Catholics for a range of reasons. But mind you, I know a lot of people who actually kept going to Mass and just took the pill, you know, so I don't think we can necessarily blame Humanae Vitae for that. When you ask Catholics why they don't go to Mass, people who identify as Catholic and they don't go to Mass, you ask them why, and they have a bunch of reasons, but the main reason that comes up in all of the surveys and all of the questions is that I actually don't believe it. I don't believe it, and I don't think I should have to go to Mass in order to be a Catholic. So where did they get that idea from? That's an interesting one. That's a real change from the culture of the 1950s and 60s where Catholics were just routinely told, you've got to go to Mass on Sunday. That's, you know, it's really important. So all of this, I think the root cause is a loss of a sense of the supernatural, that Catholics, who people who identify as Catholics in Australia actually don't believe a lot of it because they don't really believe in the supernatural. They don't really believe in God, that they're embarrassed by a lot of the more woo-woo stuff, you know, in the Catholic religion. They find Mass a bore because they don't really understand it. They've not been taught to understand it, maybe by their parents, maybe by their Catholic school. There's all sorts of reasons, better things to do on a Sunday. You know, a lot of people, it's just, yikes, they don't want to get out of bed in the morning, or the kids have got sport, or the kids have got stuff on, and that cuts across the whole Mass going. They don't want to do it. I think the root cause, though, is that disbelief. Actually, the American theologian Larry Chapp, that's what he calls it. It's like disbelief. They actually don't believe, and he includes priests and bishops in that pool of disbelief as well.
But how did, isn't that a symptom rather than a cause? I mean, because how did that disbelief arise? Is it because, what's the role of government funding as well? Because has that actually changed the focus and these organizations and pushed them away from focusing on what they used to believe to making sure that they tick the compliance boxes for current government policy? Is that?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely part of it. It's a good question where disbelief comes from, because belief is something you actually have to be taught. And one of the factors which I did identify in the book was that the Catholic Church decided to loosen the regulations around marrying non-Catholics. And Catholics in Australia absolutely ran with that. I had no idea until I saw the data. Before, it was 1966, that's when they changed the rules. Before that, it was about 21% of Catholics in Australia would marry a non-Catholic. But after that, it was more than 50% of church-going Catholics were marrying non-Catholics. When you do that, there's always problems bringing up the children as Catholics. And, you know this from your own experience. You know it from your friends' experiences. You know, you see it. So when you have a marriage between a Catholic and a non-Catholic, the kids are a lot less likely to be taken to church. The parents are a lot less likely to talk about religion with them in the home. It's like, this is a thing, because it's a source of contention in the marriage sometimes. So if the kids don't learn it at home, they're not going to learn it in their Catholic school, where they're being taught by people who also didn't learn it in their home, and where they're surrounded also by non-Catholics. Because that's, you know, like with the government funding to Catholic schools, they did become a very attractive subsidised private education for lots of middle-class people and lots of aspirational people, which is fine. Nobody minds that. But the schools are heading towards the point where it's going to be majority non-Catholic enrolment within a few years' time. So how can a school continue to call itself Catholic under those circumstances is a whole nother discussion. So, you know, you've got multiple factors acting on, you know, a young person growing up. If they're not taught belief in all the places where you have to be taught belief, which is in the home, probably backed up by the school, probably backed up in the church as well, if you do get taken to Mass on Sundays, you're not going to believe. It's really that simple.
Yeah, it's interesting. 66, that restriction was lifted. So that was also about the same time that Australia changed its immigration laws, and gradually from that became, and I'm sure there was some link between the two of them. Do you think there's also the influence of the fact that we've become like this multi-ethnic society that we weren't back in 1966 was much more, yes, there were different denominations of Christianity, and there was, you know, a small Jewish community and small others as well. But we're now there's not the same broad common culture, and so is that also it's made it more difficult for institutions, laws, and other things to maintain that.
Well, the Australian Catholic Bishops Conference and the institutional type Catholic Church loves immigration. They love it. And in fact, they depend on it because we've had to bring in so many clergy from overseas because we didn't nurture a culture of priestly vocations at home for all sorts of reasons, not believing in the supernatural, being embarrassed, pressure from feminist lobby groups as well too, that the priesthood is something dying out. We need to replace it with women. We need to replace it with lay people. So all of those things that disincentivize young men, young Catholic men to actually become a priest, they were all very much in operation in the 80s and 90s. But since then, the tide has turned and domestic ordinations are actually on the increase, which is nice. But in that time, absolutely, we've been importing clergy. No one really knows how many, which is, again, we come back to this bad data question. We don't really know how many we've got. We know that some of them came here as migrants and then became clergy. Some of them came here as priests from overseas, and some of them came here to train as priests and, you know, took over from there. The people who complain the most about the migrant priests in the Australian church are oddly the boomers. You know, so again, they're the people who have the most liberal views theologically, but they're really intolerant when it comes to ethnic differences. I've always found that really funny. Certainly countries like in the US and in France, parts of Europe, they're doing a lot better with having domestic vocations, again, because they've put the effort in. And I think there are dioceses in Australia where local bishops are putting the effort in to attract local men to go into the priesthood, and that might help to temper that. Relying on immigration is so risky with clergy because the government could change the visa laws tomorrow and we could suddenly have to send them all back. And something like that did happen in New Jersey in the United States quite recently, about a year or so ago. There were some changes in religious visa laws, and immediately the diocese had to think, yikes, we're going to lose a huge bunch of our clergy. So, loves immigration.
You moved into the issue about foreign priests, which I was going to ask you about. And you say that despite the impression that's sometimes given, there isn't actually a shortage of priests in Australia because the number of lay people attending masses has dropped so dramatically that it isn't a question of, but there are issues with having the priests in the right places and people in regional and other communities. But why precisely there needs to be, you know, the importation of foreign priests when they've got plenty of people that they could minister to in their home countries isn't adequately explained, right?
Yes, and that's the thing that, because you see, I mean, theoretically, I don't have a problem with anyone saying Mass as long as they're ordained. You know, I don't care who they are. But the problem comes when we rely on them. We start to rely on that as a substitute for domestic vocations. We could lose them all to migration, you know, to a change in visa laws. But also the fact that we need to be doing the work here and not taking people away from, say, Nigeria, where there's millions of Mass-going Catholics in Nigeria, and they have something like a one for every one priest for every 3,500 Mass-going Catholics in Nigeria. It's, as far as I can tell, because their data's even worse than ours. You know, you have to kind of work this stuff out as best you can. In Australia, it's like one for every 150 Mass-going Catholics. We are not in crisis here the way that they might be in Nigeria, but we're taking priests away from that country because, you know, we didn't do the work here. And it's also buffering us from having to do parish reform, things like merging parishes and shutting stuff down. And no one wants to do that. There's no appetite whatsoever for that at diocesan level in the church today because it's a really bad look. But at some point, someone's going to have to do it. But no, I think you're right. It's like the argument that used to be made about taking Filipino nurses from the Philippines to UK's NHS. You know, it's like we're stealing them, actually, because their own country needs them really, really badly. So why are we, you know, stealing them from other countries? Yeah.
So why immigration's not just of individual priests, but of people in general has been an increasingly large issue in Australia and elsewhere across the world. But why won't large numbers of immigrants replenish the number of Catholics in Australia?
Yeah, that's an interesting one because, again, I think I'm the only person who's interested in this in the Catholic Church currently because the data's really hard to find. So I had to actually go to the list of countries we took migrants from in 22, 23 and actually look at the countries and then work out what the Catholic population was in those countries, what the mass attendance rate was in those countries because that's really hard to find as well. And I worked out, I think we probably imported in 2022 to 2023, Australia probably imported around 35,000 mass-going Catholics in total. If we did that every year until 2050, we'd have about a million mass-going Catholics. That would bolster our number of 400,000 considerably. But they'd all have to stay here. They'd all have to keep going to mass. They wouldn't be allowed to die between now and 2050. And the transformation that would happen at parish level would be absolutely extraordinary. You know, and I don't know whether the local church would cope with that, quite frankly. I mean,
where would they come from, Philippa? Where would they?
Nigeria. Other parts of Africa, Uganda, the Philippines, Vietnam. Mm. They're probably the big ones. Nigeria, Philippines and Vietnam would be the biggest sources of mass-going Catholic migration because they have very high mass attendance rates. The Philippines rate is dropping as evangelical Pentecostalism and things like that start to make inroads and, you know, Filipino people don't want to go to church because it's very corrupt and it's perceived to be very corrupt. So that number's dropping a bit. But the Vietnamese Catholics are very adherent. They absolutely stay affiliated. They go to church. They work hard and so forth. It's the same with the African Catholics as well. So that's mostly where. So, yes, our parishes would look extremely different in 2050 if that's how the Catholic Church in Australia chooses to rebuild. But, of course, it can't make that decision. That's in the hands of the federal government. So it's probably in the interests of the Catholic Church. If they want that avenue, they must placate the federal government in other ways. And that is a dangerous situation as well.
Mm. Okay, so moving back to, so we can't rely on industry can't rely on immigration, churches can't rely on immigration. They've got to somehow rebuild themselves. At the moment, going back to your football analogy, we've got this amateur club that no one really plays very much anymore, though they once did, and then we've got this massive big leagues club, which is financially supported by the taxpayer. And is branded Catholic. So what organisations in Australia today, schools, hospitals and others, should, in your view, be allowed to continue to call themselves Catholic?
Yeah, good question. I mean, you have to drill down to diocesan level with that one. And there's 28 Western Catholic dioceses in Australia. So, you know, on an individual level, you would have to drill down. And they're all governed by layers and layers of administration as well, which really shapes the tone of the schools and the religious education content in the schools. If you have a very hands-on involved local bishop who exercises some control over that, they're probably still in quite good shape in terms of being actually Catholic schools, but you don't tend to have that in Australia. And in fact, Catholic education there's a lot of public relations about the relationship with local bishops, and all of the Catholic education documentation and so forth says they have this very collaborative, you know, relation, what have you. But actually, I don't think that's true. I think they have moved themselves quite deliberately away from episcopal authority as much as they can because they don't need it. And in fact, I use the analogy, I think, of it's like remembering a teenage romance when you're approaching retirement age, you know, the relationship between these schools and the actual Catholic Church, it's like a memory, you know, from a long time ago, and you remember it with fondness and you have Catholic building names. But you have moved to a completely different place where you can actually manage without it because you're getting all this government money. So, you know, so I think really, yeah, really hard to reform, actually, Dan, given all of that.
But you've taking the schools, for example, because there's you think, if I got you right in the book, that ultimately there's no point having these state-funded organisations that happen to have a crucifix on the wall and don't really teach very much. And I think you also point out that there's actually a negative correlation between students who go there and those that continue to practice the faith. So they're actually doing harm in a way underneath that brand if your aim is to...
I don't know whether it's doing harm because he can't have causation, you know, because it's just correlation. Yeah. And certainly I did find that the less you went to a Catholic school, the better your sort of readings were across the belief area in the survey that we did of Catholics. I know, and it makes people just like, that must be run the wrong way. And I checked so many times, it's not run the wrong way. But what's skewing that is the under 40s, because a lot of the under 40s have not been near a Catholic school. Because their parents have said, no way, there's no way I'm sending my child to a Catholic school in Australia because they won't be taught Catholicism. I want them to have proper faith formation. So I will either homeschool them, I'll send them to a state school, or I'll send them to a non-Catholic private school. And that's the kind of decisions, or do all three. Some parents do all three with their kids. The kids are in and out of homeschooling and different primary schools and so forth because they're trying to educate their kids as they see fit, which is their right as parents. But they are avoiding the Catholic education system like the plague. And given that these people are likely the future of the church, that's just another step further away for Catholic education, away from the actual future of the Catholic Church.
I think you do say that many of the Catholic schools, at least, and then a similar thing should happen also to some of the other health and other institutions, they should be just turned, they should really be no longer branded Catholic, and they should be, and the true Catholic should forego any government funding and be a lot smaller, poorer, but actually probably a lot more dynamic and focused on the true.
Authentic, Dad.
Yeah.
Authentic, not true. Can't talk about true Catholics because that can get into weird territory there. Okay. But you know, I think to be honest. To be honest, and some of the people who I spoke to while I was writing the book, because it's full of people's actual first-hand accounts of stuff that's happened to them and so forth, and they've said, look, this is not working. This is so hypocritical. You know, we've got Catholic branding everywhere and we're running on government money and it's not working. This is not working. I've actually suggested selling Catholic schools to state governments. And I started suggesting this back in about 2016 and people laugh, you know, you know, as if that would ever happen. But do you know, I think sell it now before it's taken off you. that's my point of view. Don't lease it because that's prolonging the agony. I would sell it. Even if you had to sell it at less than market rates. And if you could sell some of those schools at market rates, you'd do really, really well because there's lots of inner city property there. The Catholic Church never sells anything. That's the trouble. You're dealing with people who've just, you know, been ingrained never to part with bricks and mortar. But, you know, if I were king, you know, and could make the rules, I would sell it. I would find the schools that were the least functional in terms of Catholicism in the worst diocese, and I would sell those ones first. And with the money that came in from that, you could actually set up a much smaller, not a parochial school system, but small primary schools. You could start with primary schools in outer suburbs because that's actually where most of your mass-going young families with more than a couple of kids live. And a lot of that they live out there because they've got a spouse staying at home raising the children or homeschooling them, and they can't afford to live anywhere else. They're not living in the inner cities. They're living in the outer suburbs. That's where you put these schools, and they would work alongside homeschoolers, not against them, because that's another problem, you know, this sort of competition between homeschooling and Catholic schooling. You'd work with them, and the local bishop would actually run that. And it would only take a few people to run that. And you could staff it adequately because you've just made an absolute killing from selling off your Catholic schools to the state government. So to me, I'm sitting here in a chair, you know, telling you what I would do.
But let's say you became like the Elon Musk of in charge of the Catholic Doge and were being ruthless and very hard-nosed about taxpayer dollars, wouldn't an other alternative just be to cut down dramatically the amount of taxpayer dollars going to all these organizations? Is that more realistic or not?
Actually, Dan, that would lead to a massive strike because the only thing that Catholic schools will strike about, they don't care about faith and morals, but they do care about government funding very deeply. Yeah. And bishops would go spare as well. And the only thing bishops actually care about, I think these days, a lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them, is this. This is like the sacred cow. This is the golden calf. You do not touch the funding for Catholic schools, because if you do, you'll draw down the wrath of everyone. And the staff would go out on strike as well. The staff would not go out on strike if you wanted to introduce a sex ed program that was completely at odds with Catholic teaching, because they don't care about that. What they care about is the government funding of the school. And so what people do actually tells you what they really believe, not what they say, but what they actually do. You would have so much industrial trouble on your hands. And you'd have trouble if you suggested selling them as well. But I would work out a way, I'd try and work out a way in which we could move most of the staff onto the government payroll as well, because they're already on the government payroll, Dan. That's the thing. The schools are getting so much money, it's covering the salary costs.
Yeah, look, how to put it? It's almost as though they have they're almost in some ways run worse than a government department, even though they're effectively funded like a government department, because they claim their autonomy, but they're not directly responsible to the minister in the way that a department would be. And if you were, unsympathetic to the Catholic organizations as a taxpayer, you would simply say, well, that's not how I should, it needs to be run more efficiently, right, to get better outcomes in education at least.
Yes.
But what do you say to those? Because whenever that issue is raised, they often make two points. Well, look, if you took away the Catholic funding, you'd get all the state schools would be swamped with kids. Yes. So it's actually beneficial to for the state to subsidize the Catholic system and the independent system generally. And they also would say, oh, well, look, you can't do that. That would be like the communists taking over churches and schools. Back in that's the argument they make, right? Like with hospitals and other things too, right? And so what do you say to that?
Yeah, actually, they've already taken it over. They're paying for it all. Look, currently, you are exactly right. The Catholic education system is in a wonderful position. They have negotiated themselves a wonderful arrangement where actually, yes, they do get all the money and they still retain a massive amount of autonomy over how they spend that money. And that's not extended to government schools. A compromise position, make them independent government schools, so they still have that cachet, that might save a bit of face. The whole thing. Offloading Catholic education would require such a lot of climbing down on the part of the episcopate in Australia. That also makes me realise it will never happen, because those people will never climb down. Look, the analogy with Calvary Hospital, because there was a lot of hoo-ha about that and a lot of people were talking the talk about religious persecution.
That's the one in Canberra, for those who aren't familiar.
It was Calvary Public Hospital Bruce. Or Calvary Bruce Public Hospital was its actual name, which to me suggests that the taxpayer was already paying for it, because when it's a public hospital, the taxpayer is probably paying for it. And in the ACT, hospitals, they can't own the land that they're built on. So Calvary Hospital didn't own its own land, which is another huge factor in why the government, the ACT government, was able to legislate itself into control of that hospital. I don't think that was a case of religious persecution. I think that was a case of, we actually want this. You're holding out on us. You've got no legs to stand on because we're paying for everything, so we're just going to take it. And that is where I would caution every Catholic healthcare organisation to look at its raison d'etre, look at its holdings, look at how it's run, and look at how much government funding it's getting. Because if you're similarly exposed, now would be the time to do something about that. Yes, it is true. If we shut down the Catholic education system tomorrow, the state schools couldn't cope with the number of kids. But, I'm not talking about shutting it down. I'm talking about actually making what is a de facto situation into a de jure one. So we're moving from, or de jure, if you prefer, moving from Catholic in name, government funded, to government funded. And you could still keep the building names if you really wanted to. You could still call it St. Catherine's or St. Ursula's or whatever. I wouldn't have a problem with that. You could wear a blazer. Who cares? You know, but just to move it under government authority, because that's actually where it belongs now. It doesn't belong under the Catholic Church's aegis any longer.
In Australia, for historical reasons, the government has funded the schools, or provided considerable funding to the schools. That hasn't been the case in the same way, at least in the United States, and other parts of the Europe is different. Obviously, the UK is different too. But they have also experienced the same precipitous decline in mass attending Catholics. So it's not just that. Mm. What's beige Christianity?
Yes, I know. Look, when I start talking about Catholic education to my American friends, their eyes glaze over because it's like, we don't get this. Like, what is your problem? You've got it good. Stop complaining. The decline in mass attendance in the United States is less drastic than it is here. So I think some of the estimates that I've read are around about 25%, which is way above what we're doing, which is about 8% of nominal Catholics actually going to mass. So, yeah. What was the actual question part?
I sort of sped straight into it, but asked what is beige Christianity?
Christianity, that's right.
And because you, I think that's your term, and it.
Yeah.
Well,
no.
You explain it and why it might be related to this question.
Bishop Robert Barron in the United States came up with this term beige Christianity, and it's one that Larry Chapp uses it a lot too, as well as this like disbelief concept. But actually, it was something that George Pell brought up in Australia back in the 90s. He said, we'll become the bland leading the bland. You know, that beige Christianity is where all of the vigour is enervated. You take out the supernatural from Christianity, from Catholicism, you reduce everything to the lowest common denominator. So everything is beige. You have a very beige liturgy where, wouldn't it be nice if everyone was nice? Seems to be kind of the theme of going to Mass. Wouldn't it be nice if everyone was nice? We're all nice. We sing a song about being nice to each other, and then we all smile at each other, and then we listen to some stories about how Jesus was nice, and, you know, then we all trudge up to Holy Communion, even though we just think it's a special meal with God. And then we all go home and we just forget. We forget about the whole thing until we have to do it again the next week. There's nothing there with, there's no there. There's no core. There's no difficulty. There's no contradiction. There's no demands placed on you by beige Catholicism. And this is something I do talk about in the book. Catholic identity is really easy to assume. Anyone can call themselves a Catholic, which is why measuring that in a survey is pointless. Mm. What you actually need to ask a person is, how often do you go to church? Do you go to Mass every Sunday? That tells you whether that person is a serious Catholic or whether they're just assuming a Catholic identity. A beige Catholic who can, you know, say and think whatever they like about the church's teachings, because nothing is going to affect them. They can recommend all the changes to the church's teachings they like, because they're not going to be there to have to live with the consequences of changing that kind of stuff. So, yeah, beige, very beige. The hymns particularly. Wow.
But it's not just, I guess what I'm getting at is, it's not just beige. This beige Christianity is a phenomenon not just amongst the Catholic Church, but amongst all sorts of other, what they call in the US mainline denominations, right? Yeah. And it clearly doesn't work in getting people to church. The numbers fall off, and yet they continue to think of it being the way forward. I also think there's a parallel with other, you know, non-religious organizations, in that you've still got typically political organizations, rotaries and everything else. You have that same sort of demographic split where there's an older set that think they're really obsessed about young people, but they don't actually know what young people are looking for these days, and they double down on it. Yeah. Is liberalism the cause of the decline more generally in these institutions, because they're not focused as much on passing on the rites, traditions, the people to the next generation, but are instead focusing on breaking down barriers and, you know, changing rules and getting a buzz out of all. Is that the same? Is that what's happening in the Catholic Church, like it's happening in other areas?
I think if you, by liberalism you mean like rampant individualism and the, you know, the cult of the self and the cult of what I feel is actually the most important thing in the whole world and I'm going to impose that on everyone around me. Absolutely. I mean, go woke, go broke, Dan. the Catholic Church is in the same situation there. I mean, we were the pioneers of go woke, go broke because we did it back in the 60s. And now look at us, you know, we're down to 400,000 people who go to church in the whole country. That's what happens, you know, when you take purpose and meaning and you know, tradition is about that. It's about passing on to your children something that you have actually found tremendously important. You and your family and a group of other people have actually lived by this and you've tested it and you've found that it works. And so you really want to, you value it. You really want to pass that on to your children. If you don't value it, you will not pass it on to your children. So, you know, if we have a whole tranche of people across a whole range of institutions for whom taking part in this has actually been about personal fulfillment, you know, rather than perhaps doing something that's building up society, that's building up the family, supporting, you know, a greater good than just you getting a kick out of it, then yeah, you're probably not going to pass that on to your kids because it's like, well, you know, you do you, that's fine. But if you think it's important, you'll pass it on.
Amongst the professional Catholics, that what you call them, these people that receive salaries but probably don't go to church, it's hard to get the data exactly on that, but I would assume
possible. I'd say, Dan,
but it would be a very interesting question to get a proper answer to. But there's a obsession now with like better management expertise, and you know, and I just when I think listen to them, they miss this. Even if you were going to do a proper kind of Harvard Business Review case study on the Catholic Church, what's going wrong and what isn't, the answer would be, with you know the best you know corporate management minds, clearly you're getting young people come into this type of arrangement and you're losing and outdoing what you're currently doing. You need to therefore change and focus on your, you know, the new customers that are coming in. And yet they are, my experience at least, and I'm sure it's yours too, they are simply impossible to move on that point. They're not really focused on the, it's driven by more than better management strategies. It's they're ideologically stuck in a different era. Yeah,
absolutely. Yes, when in doubt, in the Catholic Church, when in doubt, employ some people. You know, quickly create an office for fill in the gap and put a director in charge of it, give them a secretary, give them a phone, yeah, and you fix the problem and then everyone can forget about the problem because you fixed it. This is similar with Catholic education, and I have described it as the great employer of the nation's brothers-in-law. Having had two brothers-in-law in it myself, I know that within Catholic circles, everyone either is related to someone or knows someone who works in Catholic education, Catholic healthcare, or works for a diocesan bureaucracy. It's like the network analysis that you could do here would be extraordinary because it's a very, very small group of people, really. And they're always the ones who get the jobs. And the jobs are reasonably well paid. They are indoor work with no heavy lifting. And you can feel like you're really contributing, you know, to the future of the church. But actually, you're part of the problem. You're part of the cholesterol in the arteries there, you know, that's clogging everything up because you don't solve the problems in the Catholic Church by employing more people. And certainly the plenary council, we had this plenary council a few years ago. We were supposed to address all of these issues in the church.
Just explain what that is, Philip, because not everyone tuning in will be into this.
What, Dan? What? I find that hard to believe. The plenary council, every now and then you can have one, and you've got to get permission from Rome, basically, to do it. You have a national, like a big jamboree, a big Catholic jamboree, where you might have issues of national importance in the Catholic Church to address. So you have to get everyone involved because you're going to come up with ideally some big solutions. And ours was nonsense. It was nonsense from start to finish because it was completely hijacked by people who thought we should ordain women and, you know, we should employ more people. That was the problem. We should employ lots more people and, you know, just nonsense really, and very little good, I think, actually came out of this process. But it probably cost a great deal of money to run, and they've never published the figures on how much it costs to run as well, which I also think is hugely funny.
And it was a bogus consultation too. I think you outline in the book you're quite involved, you're quite informed, you write, you know, prolifically on different matters in the Catholic Church. One would think if you were donning your Harvard Business School hat that you would they'd be interested in your perspective on things. You've written a book.
Hell no, Dan.
What was the story exactly? They gave you sort of a window of a couple of days, and they said the paper had been prepared, and if anyone has any consultations within, you know, 3 busy work days, please draft it in.
A couple of things happened. Now, to be absolutely fair, Dan, I was approached early on in the process, mm-hmm. and I was invited to try and get onto one of the working groups by someone who I won't name because they're a lovely person, but they were very keen to try and make sure that people like me actually did become involved in the plenary council. But at the time that I was invited, it was going to take 18 months time. It was not paid, and I had to be available for all of these meetings and all of these discussions. At the time, I was caring for 2 dying parents. I was trying to help my sister raise my nephew, because that's how I've lived with my sister for a long time, and we've raised her son to adulthood quite successfully. But it took a lot of work. It's his birthday today, so I'm just rubbing that in. 27, amazing. So with that kind of, and I was also working. I was working part time, and I was studying part time. Now, when am I going to go to this Gab Fest, which I knew would be full of professional Catholics who had unlimited time and unlimited energy to just drone on? And I had to say no. I said, no, I can't be involved
in
this.
But that's so typical, Philippa, isn't it? The ones who are being paid, I mean, they're happy for the meeting to drag on because they're being paid for it, whereas all the volunteers who might offer an independent perspective and a different perspective, you know, it's literally very hard to afford the time and money to attend these things, right?
So absolutely. Unless you work in the Catholic system and you got time off because you work in the Catholic education system. So ordinary families, and it wasn't just me, Dan. I know there were lots of other people who could have really contributed, but they have young families, you know, and these are actually the people who are the future of the church, and they were ipso facto screened out because they couldn't participate fully because the whole thing was, you know, during working hours, during the week when people, oddly enough, are working.
You know, well, it's a bit like the political parties where they hold a branch meeting on a Wednesday night at 8:30, and then they wonder why we don't get young women or people with families attending. Well, guys, that's going to be pretty tough for most people to do that. So putting my Harvard Business, you know, ruthless cost-cutting Doge hat, which you're really talking about, if I've got you right, basically disposing of some of the assets which are detracting from the brand, focusing on your core competencies and actually producing a much more distinctive brand which is authentic to what the brand is meant to represent, right? That's it in a nutshell, isn't it?
And you might get a Jesus would say, Dan, go out and preach the gospel.
but you can't get people attracted to a brand when it's spread so wide and it becomes beige, like you say, and it's not. So I live in the inner city of Brisbane, and there is this broader, I think, like hunger for or interest in spirituality, but it's channeled into things like, you know, the yoga and the other. And I kind of think, what would it take for Catholicism to obtain that kind of yoga mum prestige? Because, you know, there's a certain kind of like trendy, like, you know, where, oh, that I get, you know, they get their social and other connections and whatever have, but it does have a certain trendy branding. And again, the Catholic Church is not about being trendy, but I think you understand what I'm saying. It does have to have a certain value to the brand in and of itself, because I think that probably was the case amongst, you know, minority Catholics in England or other things, like we're, you know, holding true to it, and we're, which I don't think exists anymore. If you're serious about having it continue on, there does need to be a much more, like, that's management talk, like branding and everything else. Obviously, there's more to the whole thing than that. But, you know, that is what you're ultimately proposing, right? A much more narrow focus type of
Look at where they're packing them in the Catholic Church in Australia today, traditional Latin Mass. And not even just the traditional Latin Mass, but the parishes where the priest doesn't say a Latin Mass, but he just says Mass properly. Like he actually pays attention to what he's doing rather than making it into a cabaret show about himself and telling dad jokes. You know, where you have a priest, and this is how it turns around, basically, at grassroots level. This is what I've observed. You get a good priest in a parish and he just gets on with it and people come. And more people come. We'd love the yoga mums, Dan. It's not, you know, we wouldn't go out looking for them, but I've met converted yoga mums because some people, it's like they went through that phase and they're looking for something bigger. And now it's like, here's this really weird thing, but it's what we might call full fat, high fiber Catholicism. Yeah. It's thick religion that brings people in. If people are genuinely spiritually searching, they will come. It's what draws people to Jordan Peterson. It's what draws people to, you know, conservative ideas across the board, I think. Certainty. They have certainty and they have tradition behind them. So they have a proven track record. This is your brand. Like you can point to the, you know, illustrious tradition, if you like, that's in operation, and buy into that and not be ashamed of it. So there is definitely room for the yoga mums, but you won't get it with a slick ad campaign and you won't get it on Instagram or anything like that.
But it is a thing of beauty, the Catholic Church overall, right? And it's produced high art, you know, paintings and they have been the byproducts, obviously, of the spirit and everything else. They're not everything. I think there's a great G.K. Chesterton quote where he says, you know, something about you can't, someone who goes to Italy and just admires the paintings and the music and stuff, doesn't actually like the religion is a dilettante or something along those lines. So again, it's not just about that, but you've got these incredible trappings, which I sort of think people do appreciate in the broader culture. And the challenge, at least, is to explain, you know, how these things arise and that it is useful to be part of and contribute to the tradition and culture that produce them in a deeper sense. Yeah. I guess I'm going to finish off, Philippa, because I've taken a while, although I love chatting. What do you think, apart from your cost-cutting drive in this new Catholic Doge and a complete restructuring of the whole thing, what areas are there cause for hope for the future?
Lots, because I think, look, I invented Martyr's Law, which says the smaller a local church gets, the weirder it gets, because the only people who stay in the Catholic Church in the current conditions are the people who really believe it. And yet a lot of them are kind of weird, you know, and that's not a problem. The people
Well, it can be sometimes though, right? Because so everyone is clear, I find you very sensible in your approach, because things can go off the rail with people that are trying to get really, really Catholic, and you know, they need a bit of guidance. They always have needed guidance, right? Of course, for hope in the future.
Yeah, that people are doubling down, that people are willing to go out on a limb. Look, they got like 15,000 people at the Corpus Christi procession in Sydney last year, 15,000 people willing to come out in public on the street in a Catholic, really obviously Catholic public procession. That's more than they've ever had before. I think things like World Youth Day here did huge good. It's because it's like a public witness. That's why I call the book Witness, apart from anything else, because that's actually one of the signs of hope, is that people are more willing to stand up for what they believe. They're more willing to be identified as Catholics, even when it's painful or difficult or unfashionable. I think that's actually what it takes as well. Courageous example, a lot of the time is what that attracts people as well too. So, there are lots of signs of hope, but they're little and they're widely spread out. There's little parishes, little community groups, online networks. There's some really good ones of those. Yep. And increasing numbers of people coming to Mass in particular places in Australia, not just the traditional Latin Mass, but in other areas as well. And they're younger. They're younger and they're having kids. That's the thing, because that's really putting your money where your mouth is when you're a Catholic. If you decide to go the kid thing, and have, you know, more than perhaps one and a half children, and they're doing it. These young people are doing it. And I think that's amazing. I take my hat off to them and I hope they're going to carry us forward.
Yeah. Oh, the churches die when there's not kids falling out of the screaming in the aisles, right? You know, but
and there's never, I was trying to,
it's never been easier for people to access really high quality resources on the internet and everything else, as opposed to being at the mercy of the sort of somewhat often substandard sort of local priest. Sometimes very good, but often substandard. So in that note, I will direct your people to your new book, because I do think I think even non-Catholics will find it quite interesting, simply as an audit of what is the largest denomination in Australia, which has a lot of assets, a lot of operational businesses in health, education, and otherwise. And hopefully the powers that be, both state and religious, take it on board. Have you received much feedback already? I know it hasn't formally out, but have you people, I don't know, gripping the side of their desk going, oh my God, you know, what's he going to say? In the bureaucracy?
Everyone who has read it so far has really loved it, but that's quite a small number of people. Certainly, Professor Jim Franklin's going to launch it in Sydney, and apparently he said to someone the other night, it's very hard-hitting, and I thought, good, good, because it is. It's meant to be quite hard-hitting. It's meant to be an uncomfortable read if you're part of this sort of mess, you know, that we've gotten ourselves into. But I'm so sick of people rehashing the same problems. I know the problems in the church inside and out. I've heard about them for the last 35 years. I want to propose some solutions, because I think we've got to get away from just rehashing problems and try and find a way forward before it is imposed on us from outside.
Yeah, which will, like, it's coming down the line, right, one way or another.
And very, very easy to do. Yeah.
Well, thanks again, Philippa. Like, I recommend the book to everyone. It's not written in Latinate prose. It's written in very punchy modern style with Philippa's trademark kind of wit on occasion. So I'll recommend it to others when it eventually comes out. It is available on Amazon. And apart from that, Philippa, you still write online for a variety of different publications. If people want to read more about you and what you do, where could they go?
The Catholic Weekly is probably the best place. I have a weekly column at the Catholic Weekly, in which I, you know, sound off about all kinds of things. They're very tolerant. They haven't thrown me out yet. The Catholic Weekly is one of the very few, I think, really good Catholic media sources in Australia that's left. Mm. Most of them have gone. Yeah, so that's why I'm really happy to write for them. But if you Google me, I Google very strangely because I do a lot of things. So there's only one Philippa Marta. There's not, you know, three or four of me. It's actually me doing all of that stuff when you Google me.
Cool. Sounds good. Okay, great. Philippa, look forward to catching up and again, recommend everyone purchase the book and wrap their head around what's going on in this big organization that, is, you know, hopefully isn't going away anytime soon. Leave it to it.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you very much. Witness the future Catholic Church in Australia. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Philippa. Bye.